Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in Fisher versus University of Texas, a case many court watchers believe will bring an end to the practice of using racial preferences to determine who gets into U.S. colleges and universities. Joining the fray are Richard H. Sander and Stuart Taylor Jr., who argue in their new book, Mismatch, that affirmative action policies that allow underprepared minority students to gain admission to the country's elite schools are hurting the very students they're designed to help. Richard Sander is a law professor and economist at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a well-known scholar on race and higher education. Welcome to our show. And Stuart Taylor is a leading legal journalist and former Supreme Court reporter at the New York Times, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back.
Nice to be with you.
Mismatch is published by Basic Books. Affirmative action has been a contentious issue for years. Richard, how likely is it that the Supreme Court will abolish the use of racial preferences in college admissions altogether? Haven't some of the justices, most notably Clarence Thomas, already made their opposition to it known?
Yes. There are certainly a few justices, maybe four justices, that would be willing to abolish preferences altogether. But I think that's...
So who's the swing vote in this one?
Well, Justice Kennedy is.
Again.
But even the four, I think, on this case, Stuart probably knows the answer to this better, but, you know, Fisher is a somewhat idiosyncratic case. It's posing some fairly narrow issues, and it's importantly, it's brought against a public university under the 14th Amendment. So for all those reasons, it's very unlikely they would eliminate racial preferences as they affect private schools. But even with public schools, I think my sense is that Kennedy and maybe some of the others would rather try to strengthen the existing restrictions and make them more tangible than take the full step against preferences.
I agree, and I would just add that, in fact, in the last big decision, the University of Michigan decisions in 2003, which is the best evidence we have of what Justice Kennedy thinks, his dissenting opinion, although he would have struck down the University of Michigan Law School Affirmative Action Program, he made it pretty clear that he was not prepared to say never. He was not prepared to say you cannot consider race. It's not entirely clear, you know, where he would draw the line, but I don't think he's headed towards abolition.
Well, what kind of impact would a decision in favor of Fisher have on the racial makeup of the nation's colleges and universities? Would, as many fear, a ruling like that result in drastic declines in Black, Native American, and Hispanic enrollments?
Well, certainly not in the short term. The track record of colleges in response to the last two Supreme Court decisions has been to interpret them as conservatively as possible and to leave their policies largely intact. They sometimes will change the name. Like after the 2003 Grutter decision, many colleges and universities adopted what they called holistic admissions because O'Connor had used that term. But substantively, they were doing something very, very similar to what they did before. And that was pretty large racial preferences. So I think if the Fisher decision issues some fairly specific restrictions, you'll probably see universities taking small steps towards that. But what you would really be waiting for is then follow-up lawsuits that would be more specifically targeted on particular questions.
Well, the majority of college officials and liberal politicians support affirmative action. And Stuart, you say in your book that for many years you and Richard were uncritical supporters of racial preferences in college admissions. When did your views start to change?
Rick can speak for himself. Mine started to change about 1989, 1990. I'd been with the New York Times covering these cases for a while. I hadn't, I'd sort of internalized the general journalistic approval of them. Then I became an opinion writer in 1989, and I had to actually decide what I thought about these things. And in the meantime, various concerns about how it was working built up in me. In the meantime, affirmative action had changed. Even by that time, it was becoming a program that benefited well-off minorities, Blacks and Hispanics, at the expense of less well-off whites and Asians.
The original intent was to help less well-off people.
Yeah. In other words, it got to be on the wrong side of economic equality.
So it became a class issue for you.
It's become – it's partly it's a whole mix of things, but class is part of it.
And then for me, I was a civil rights activist during the 80s and 90s and got into affirmative action because I was trying to see – I was trying to document how well it worked. And I did a lot of research on academic support programs at law schools and started looking at the statistics and was seeing some very troubling patterns where students – admitted with preferences to more elite schools were having a terrible time on bar exams, much lower than it appeared they would do if they went to a less elite school. So that kind of started this whole mismatch inquiry.
Have people looked at you a bit askance because you were a community organizer in Chicago? After all, that phrase has been used to tar a certain president of the United States.
In academic circles, it gives you credence. So that part hasn't hurt me. I've been looked at askance for criticizing affirmative action, though.
But you've said that although the current system is rotten, you would rather see it amended than abolished.
That's right. And we have a couple of reasons for that. We think that when states have abolished it by law, as California did in Proposition 209, the evasions to which the universities have resorted to get around the ban on racial preferences have sometimes been worse. They have sometimes taken people who are less well qualified than the people they take through ordinary economic preferences.
And why are the universities using those evasions? Because they see it in their best interest to have as much diversity as possible?
Or is it just that
they're all so liberal?
There's a quasi-religious devotion on campus, but not only on campus, among university leaders and leaders of other institutions towards using as much racial preference as necessary to get the numbers of each racial group about where they want them. And one reason is if you're running an institution, it's very hard to run an institution that does not use racial preferences without opening yourself up to protests, lawsuits, bad media, and the like.
And we're actually living through a case study of this right now because Chapter 10 of the book talks about evasions of Prop 209 in California. Prop 209 is the law, the initiative passed in 1996 that that required the state to stop using racial preferences. And in the book, we talk about how the University of California gradually became more and more aggressive in trying to find substitutes for race. And then UCLA in 2007 started actually using race again covertly. So the book documents some of this, and when that came out, the immediate reaction at UCLA was an indignant letter of protest by 59 professors, a series of massive protests by students. The campus was in an uproar. And
protests in defense of affirmative action?
Well, the argument was that the insinuation that UCLA was admitting too many minority students was a racist insinuation. So even though we were simply focusing on whether discrimination was in play, that was being cast in racist versus non-racist terms. And university officials couldn't scramble quickly enough to sort of assert that, no, there's nothing wrong with what we're doing. We're going to keep doing exactly what we're doing. And they would clearly prefer a lawsuit, which is likely to come, against their racial practices, then face the wrath of students and faculty.
My guests are Richard H. Sander and Stuart Taylor Jr. Their book, Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. It's published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Does Fisher versus University of Texas offer the court an opportunity to make the kinds of changes you believe need to be made?
I'd say yes and no. They don't really deal with the evidence that's the core of our book, a lot of it rich statistical work, which is that it's actually harming the minorities it's supposed to help by putting them into academic situations where they can't compete. They're not going to dig into that. But the remedies that we propose, not abolition, but transparency, requiring public disclosure of the size, operation, and effects of these racial preferences, plus prioritizing socioeconomic diversity ahead of racial identity, the Supreme Court could start down both of those roads, and I wouldn't be surprised to see them start down the transparency road without getting into the mismatch evidence.
Well, Abigail Fisher, the white middle-class plaintiff, has complained that she was a victim of reverse discrimination, which is something you don't focus on in this book. And it's a very limited thing. It would be like me saying I'd always wanted to get into Yale, because my father went to Yale, and then they didn't take me in because they took a black person in. It sounds like a rather weak legal argument. But yet everybody assumes the Supreme Court is going to somehow go along with it.
Well, the substantive harm that whites and Asians can point to as a result of preferences for blacks and Hispanics, we think is a pretty modest harm. Substantively, it just means they're going to a slightly less elite school. But the formal harm is real. In other words, the indignity and frustration of being treated based on your skin color is something that affects people across the board. And so that gives Fisher standing. And what puts
that's
Texas,
what Clarence Thomas has also talked about, even though he benefited from affirmative action. He says it stigmatizes the people who receive it.
It stigmatizes the beneficiaries and offends the non-beneficiaries. And Texas has put itself in a weak position because the 2003 Grutter opinion specifically said you can't do racial balancing. You can't tie your preferences to the state's demographics. And the University of Texas has clearly done that.
Your analysis has revealed that at selective schools, more than 80% of blacks and 2/3 of Hispanic students have received admissions preferences equal to at least a 100-point boost in their SAT scores and often much more. Didn't you find that the students who'd gotten the largest preferences were at the greatest risk of having both academic and social problems in school? How does that compare with students who get athletic scholarships or are legacy students?
Well, part of the problem in answering that question is the lack of transparency. I mean, our estimate of racial preferences is a conservative one. We're sure it's at least that extensive. Legacy preferences, there's remarkably little information about, and the available data shows conflicting things. We think on balance, legacy preferences tend to be smaller, substantially smaller than racial preferences. But they're still can be very problematic for the outcomes of those students. Athletic preferences, I think, are often large. They often overlap with race. But what's different about athletic preferences is that the schools frequently have academic programs aimed specifically at athletes. They're essentially recognizing that there's a mismatch issue and that they've got to do something special to keep up the performance of those students. And the school has an incentive in the performance of those athletes. All that is missing with standard racial preferences. So these students are often left to fend for themselves. And an example of what we find kind of most dispiriting is the science mismatch problem. Blacks in high school are more likely to want to be scientists and engineers than similar whites in high school, actually a lot more likely. And when they receive large preferences and get into one of these very competitive programs, that they're overwhelmingly likely to underperform relative to their expectations and the school's expectations, and they transfer out of those tracks. So we lose a lot of minority scientists.
And Stuart, that's because they actually come from schools that haven't prepared them academically?
It's often for that reason, yes.
Going all the way back to K through 12.
That's right. K through 12 is where the real problem is, that there are huge racial disparities in the academic achievements of kids coming out of the K to 12 schools.
But the whole idea of affirmative action was, as I understood it, to get past that. You say, well, these kids were not given as good an education, K through 12, so we're going to bring them into college and because it's not a matter of intelligence. It's a matter of the quality of the education they've received.
And that would work if college was completely malleable, so that if any student with any preparation could benefit from any particular college. But colleges in the U.S. tend to be very stratified, and they tend to cluster students with particular academic skill ranges. That's why we have U.S. News rankings. And that means that students coming in with weak preparation are going to be worse off receiving that benefit. It's not a question of going to college. Blacks are much more likely than comparable whites to end up in college, actually. But it's a question of getting something out of it. So if you control for background characteristics and test scores and family income and all that stuff, blacks are about 30% more likely than similar whites to get into a four-year college, but they're about 30% less likely to get a college degree.
My guests are Richard H. Sander, a law professor and economist at UCLA, and Stuart Taylor, Jr., a former New York Times Supreme Court reporter, co-author of the critically acclaimed book Until Proven Innocent. They have collaborated on Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It, published by Basic Books. We'll continue the conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Richard H. Sander and Stuart Taylor Jr., co-authors of Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. It's published by Basic Books. There's been a lot of focus lately on the social difficulties many minority students experience at elite universities. Hasn't research shown that the students who've been given large preferences tend to spend their time almost exclusively with other students who've had preferences similar to their own?
Yes, there have been a number of studies, including one by a close collaborator of Rick's, Peter Sidiacono of Duke, that show that kids, not just across racial lines, kids tend to hang out with other kids who are doing similar things academically, both in terms of the courses they're taking and in terms of the level of sophistication.
Well, wouldn't that help? Because then they could also, they can share the things that they've learned.
Yeah, but there's been a hope since the beginning of racial preferences in admissions that through sharing and the like, that the kids who come in with less preparation will gain on everyone else.
Through diversity.
Yeah. And that hasn't happened. They tend to lose ground over the 4 years of college because of the mismatch phenomenon we've been talking about.
And you've said this mismatch first became apparent in the mid-1990s when a team of Dartmouth psychologists looked at how minority students who'd planned to major in science or technology, engineering, or math when they entered college had fared.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that was a
science. You mentioned earlier that they wanted to do well, but they were ambitious, but it was just they're just too unprepared.
Yeah. So science is a particularly easy place to see mismatch, I think, because the curriculums are fairly rigid, and each course builds on the ones before it. So if you fall behind in one, then you're really in a lot of trouble. The grading tends to be tougher. So all those things, we're not sure if it causes more mismatch, but it's certainly much easier to observe with the available
information.
Well,
couldn't they just change their majors?
They can, but that means that they're not doing what they want to do. It also means that they're more likely to take more than 4 years to finish because they've spent their first couple of years on a path they're not going to follow.
Are they also more likely to drop out of college?
Yeah, I got a long email from a fellow who went to engineering school at Michigan, an elite program, a black fellow, and he had done pretty well in high school, but not that well, and he just hit the wall. He was not able to cope with the level of preparation that was expected, the degree of work that was expected. He ended up dropping out. He ended up becoming a kind of a bitter critic of affirmative action, in part because he was saying they take people like me, they suck us in by misleading us about how well we're going to do, and then when we can't, and then we hit the wall, we're on our own.
So, would these same students have had more success completing their degrees in their chosen fields if they had attended less competitive colleges, where the academic preparation was closer to that of their peers?
Yeah, there was a great study by Smythe and McArdle, two psychologists at the University of Virginia. They were able to get access to the data that Bowen and Bach used in their famous affirmative action study, The Shape of the River. And they looked at the science mismatch issue, and they found that that blacks and Hispanics who went to schools where they were well-matched finished science degrees at about an 80% higher rate. And, you know, going back to your point about switching majors, I just finished a project with economist Mark Lupino at the University of California, and we found that surprisingly a lot of blacks and Hispanics were reluctant to switch majors. They felt that they made this investment, they were going to try to stick with it, and the result is they ended up not graduating. So instead of just sort of getting an English degree at Berkeley or UCLA, they just dropped out.
Now, you mentioned Proposition 209 in California. You teach at UCLA. Are you an eyewitness to these problems in California?
Yeah, very much. You know, I teach mostly graduate students, but I've got access to better information as a professor. And what's striking is that from the get-go, there were these very surprising things happening in California. So the first year it went into effect in 1998, there was an expectation of a catastrophic drop in black and Hispanic enrollment, partly because racial preferences would be gone, but partly it was thought that blacks and Hispanics would just be turned off by the fact that the school was no longer embracing preferences. And what we observed instead was something that we call a warming effect, where blacks and Hispanics were actually much more keen to accept offers of admission from top UC schools than they had been before. It seems like they really wanted to go to a race-neutral school.
Didn't you also find that black students are less likely to become academics go on to become college professors?
It wasn't actually our finding. There was an amazing book written in 2003 that almost nobody has ever heard of since, called Increasing Faculty Diversity, by Eleanor Barber, now dead, and Stephen Cole, both academics. And they were retained by a group of Ivy League presidents to study, you know, what's wrong? Why can't we get more blacks and Hispanics who become professors who have doctorates? And their conclusions were a surprise that led the Ivy League presidents to try and bury the book unread by anyone. Their conclusions were, well, of course, the fact that the big problem is there aren't enough doctorates, but one reason for that is affirmative action is taking students who want to be professors, who are good students, who would have done very well at a moderately competitive place, putting them in places where they do badly, destroying their self-confidence, and causing them to abandon their aspirations.
Still, you've noted that the case against preferences is weakest at the most elite schools. You've called them the super elite schools. Which schools are considered super elite, and why do preferences work better at them?
Well, let's consider Harvard, Yale, and Princeton.
So let's consider them.
All right.
I couldn't get into any one of them.
Yeah. Well, they have the pick of the litter, right? They pretty much can decide among all American high school students who they want. And that means that when they're using preferences, they're the first movers. That they can pick blacks and Hispanics who are academically competitive with whites and Asians, you know, the ones who are at the very top of the distribution. And then they use preferences to sort of round out their numbers. And as we show in part of the book, that means that they end up reaching down to, say, the fourth tier of black students while they're admitting from the first tier of white and Asian students. But overall, that means that their preferences are, on average, are much smaller than they would be. So then a school that's one tier down or two tiers down is starting where they're leaving off. They're starting with, say, the fifth tier of African-American students, and therefore they've got to use large preferences even for their academically strongest black students. So the average preference used by those less elite schools is much larger. So at Harvard and Yale, the average preference size is smaller, and they've got this, you know, enormous resource of investment that they can put into students. So their graduation rates are very close to 100%.
Diana from Madison, New Jersey asks, do educational opportunity services or similar programs actually help bring students who may not have had the same educational background up to the same level as the wealthier students?
Well, that's sort of what I started with back in the 90s when I got into this, is academic support. And it's absolutely true, I think, that if schools made the kind of commitment to affirmative action admits that they make to, say, athletic admits, and said, you know, we're admitting you, we're taking ownership of you, we're going to make sure that we provide whatever programs are needed so that you can succeed, I think you could really ameliorate all of these mismatch effects. And so part of the idea of transparency, part of the reason we don't want to get rid of racial preferences altogether, is to see if there are ways of increasing university accountability so that the schools take more ownership of these students.
What happens to the talented but underprepared minority students who attend elite colleges but don't do well, or drop out or graduate near the bottom of the class? Does that actually hurt them after they leave?
We think the evidence is mixed, but we think it does, particularly if they didn't go to Harvard, Yale, or Princeton for the reasons we talked about. First, the cachet of certain degrees, maybe the top five, maybe the top 10, is so unique that being at the bottom of your class probably doesn't prevent you from getting a good job. But if you're at like the 30th or the 50th ranked college in the country and you're at the bottom of your class, it could be a huge problem getting a job, but more, perhaps worse, it destroys intellectual self-confidence. Almost every selective university in the country is a like two-tiered, color-coded academic hierarchy with the minority kids at the bottom, and the habit arises that, well, minorities don't do well, and this is internalized. I mean, the minority kids are very well aware of this. And by the way, I hope it's clear that we're not saying to them, you don't deserve to be where you are. We're saying to them, you know, you are the major victim of affirmative action and you might do better somewhere else.
But getting back to that listener's question, if schools are going to have affirmative action programs, wouldn't it be in their best interest to have, at least in the first year, some kind of program that helps bring these kids, because many of them are quite smart, up to the level, educational level, as their classmates?
So here's an interesting example that I think illustrates all the dynamics. If you compare law schools and medical schools, so in law school, large preferences are used. Students tend to get bad grades. Students who receive preferences tend to get bad grades. And that leads to horrendous bar passage rates. Most elite schools, blacks are passing the bar at a 50 or 60% rate compared to over 90% for whites. So a lot of those African Americans are either greatly delayed or they never become professionals at all. So that's a pretty tangible harm. Medical schools use the same size preferences as law schools, but their national boards occur halfway through medical school. So the medical school knows which students have run into trouble. And medical schools almost universally have very ambitious academic support programs for students who fail the boards. So the black students who get into medical school will receive extra help as a third year. And their graduation rates and eventual licensing rates are much closer to white rates. So it's really two different models where the medical schools are taking more ownership of their students.
I would add one thing, though. I think remedial help, although it's good and they should do it and they don't do it enough, I don't think it's a total cure. When you have a huge gulf between the entering academic qualifications of different levels of students, I think your work, Rick, on academic support at UCLA showed that although it helped, the bar passage rates were still huge racial differences even after all this academic support.
Yeah, that's an important qualification. I mean, you're still trying to get the institution to do something that it's not ideally suited for doing, so it's a bit of a band-aid.
I want to get back to something we skimmed over earlier. A 1992 survey showed that two-thirds of black students at elite colleges came from the top 25% of the American socioeconomic distribution, the upper middle class and the upper class. Can we assume the trend has continued in the 10 years since?
It likely has not gotten any better.
Because the whole idea is to help poor kids, but we're really saying that affirmative action is helping the wealthy, the children of wealthy families.
Except we're saying it's not always helping them, but go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, it's being received by the children of affluent families. And you know, related to that, Leonard, is this general targeting problem. Race has become a weaker and weaker proxy for disadvantage in American society. Among the black population, we now have you know 20%, something like 20% of blacks are first or second generation immigrants. That group not only faces very different sorts of historical experiences from traditional African Americans, but they also tend to do much better on test scores. So they are capturing a very disproportionate number of these affirmative action slots. Then there's a growing number of mixed race kids. I have a mixed race African American son, and that's the fastest growing racial group in America. All those folks are, you know, are very ambiguous in the affirmative action system. Hispanics are a very imprecise ethnic group. Asians include all sorts of ethnicities, some of which are disadvantaged and some of which aren't. So race is just becoming increasingly untenable as a mechanism compared to looking at individual socioeconomic characteristics.
And you learned that an admissions officer tried to pass off an Egyptian student as black a way of coming up with a quota.
One thing that the research makes pretty clear is that, as Shelby Steele, a black critic of affirmative action, has put it, every university in America, every selective university, will accept the child of a black doctor ahead of the child of a white cab driver every single time, even if the child of the white cab driver is much better qualified. And that's the sense in which this is a force for economic inequality, not what it used to be, which is the reverse.
But hasn't the basic story in the past been immigrant comes to this country, works hard, sends the kid to some school, usually not an elite school. That kid does well and sends his kid to an elite school. Right. Why isn't that working here?
It is working pretty well for immigrants. I mean, for Asian immigrants and a fair number of Hispanic immigrants, and definitely for black immigrants. That is essentially what's happening.
Black immigrants, but not people who grew up in the descendants of slaves in this
country.
That's
right. The descendants of slaves have much more durable problems. And the fact that the experience of black immigrants is so different shows us that this is not genetic. This is cultural. This is due to deep characteristics of urban institutions that are affecting their outcomes.
I think one important anecdotal insight here, and I don't claim it's a statistical study. John McWhorter, another African-American critic of affirmative action.
Well, he's also politically conservative. Does that matter?
I think I don't discount the views of anybody because of what their general political attitudes are. And by the way, I'm not sure how politically conservative he is. But he said, and I think this rings true, from the age of 10, I was aware that there was something called affirmative action that meant that black people like me did not have to work as hard as white people in order to get into the colleges they wanted, and that affected how hard I worked.
Richard H. Sanders, Stuart Taylor Jr., their book, Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, is Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. It's published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for an enlightening 40 minutes.
Thanks for having us, Leonard.
Thanks for having us.